Now, I want to talk about narcissism and the key role that plays in the development of Freud's thought. But I thought the best way to begin any Freudian reflection on narcissism is to play you a song, right? This is one of Handel's great arias, in which Semele, who was Jupiter's lover, has been given a mirror by Jupiter's angry wife to say, "You are very beautiful, look at yourself." And the words you'll find here, "Myself I shall adore if I persist in gazing." You'll find this little words of the aria. Now this is a moment, one of Handel's most extraordinary inventions of the high coloratura singing, in which narcissism becomes a kind of jouissance, a kind of the most erotic moment in the opera is not the lovemaking between Semele, the earthly maiden, and Jupiter, but Semele looking at the mirror that has been given her by Jupiter's wife in order to destroy her, and saying, "You are so beautiful, you should become a goddess." And she just repeats the same entranced, ecstatic words over and over again at higher and higher and higher levels. It comes to a kind of almost bel canto orgasm. Okay. And that verb, gazing, is just drawn out into this extraordinarily excited way as it builds up and builds up climactically. The act of gazing is a sort of, is an act of sexual coming as she looks at herself. it's an extraordinary piece of music. The two verbs that are most extended, repeated, and pushed to the highest limits of the coloratura's bel canto range are gazing and pleasing, and the rhyme between gazing and pleasing, and the structure of the sort of what's called the da capo aria, which is da capo means go back to the beginning, which is very striking in almost all Handel's operatic arias, is here kind of distended and repeated again and again. You feel almost as if she's trapped in it. She could go on singing forever. She sings the first verse, and she sings the second verse, and she goes back to the first verse, and then you expect her perhaps to go on to another verse. You're sitting there, and you haven't got a text in front of you. And that she's almost, in an extraordinary way, stuck on that gazing verse. And she just repeats it over and over again in higher and descending parts of the scale. And it's like a kind of, what you call it, a kind of pleasure mechanism that's taken her over, and she can't get off, or she can't get out, as it were. And you keep thinking, oh, it's going to end now, and then another round starts. Oh, it's going to end now, and another round starts. In one production, it was an extraordinary effect. She's looking in a mirror. She's seeing her mirror image. And when she moves from the first verse to the second verse, a voice from behind the mirror comes back, sings the next verse. And it was her recorded voice, obviously, that they put behind the mirror. The image in the mirror sings back to her. And so that sense of, you know, this redoubling of self, and at the same time an entrapment in that redoubling. And it has rhythmic patterns that are, as it were, orgasmic, but then it doesn't stop at that high point. You think, oh, it's going to end now. This is the big moment. This is the climax. And it doesn't. It starts all over again. And it gives you that sense that this could go on forever. Okay? So there is this capture of the subject in this imaginary sphere, which is both a visual sphere, and that's what Lacan, his mirror phase essay, talks about. He first formulates the notion of the imaginary around the visual phantasm. But late Lacan supplements it with a whole wonderful meditation on the voice and the role of the invocatory drive and the relation to the mother's voice, which is where he posits a further set of fundamental drives beyond what Freud had originally posited. So narcissism, self-love, which is also clearly profoundly erotic, and indeed, you know, almost like a kind of multiple orgasm of the voice around this self-doubling and self-reflecting. So voice and image are kind of inextricable in the and they come together on that word gazing, okay, which is just the A of gazing, which is just extraordinarily elaborated and repeated and in great crescendos and diminuendos of affect. It's an astonishing performance, really. And if you wanted a kind of piece of cultural evidence about the erotic nature of narcissism, you certainly have it there. Okay, well, what about narcissism as a category in Freud's thought? I tried to lay out in my email to you the way it emerges and the way it kind of disrupts in ways that are quite productive, but are disruptive, Freud's kind of conceptual system at that point. He had, and he recapitulates this in section two when he's talking about the different kinds of love relationship, the anaclitic relationship and the narcissistic relationship. He tries to set up this dualism of types of relationship. But he recaps the notion of leaning on, in which the drive leans on the instinctual function. And that had been his first formulation of the drive, which we looked at last term in the three essays of sexuality, and the emergence of the drive in the infant as initially coincident with leaning on, he uses that word, Anlehnung in German, leaning on and then deviating from the performance of an instinctual function that is designed to meet need. Okay, so the classic instance of this is that of the eating, swallowing, digesting sequence in the infant, which kicks into play. The child doesn't have to be taught or shown how to eat or digest. Okay, it's a kind of automatic, instinctual, reflexive sequence in response to the meeting of hunger, the need for food, which of course has to be provided from the outside. The child can't provide itself with hunger, but the act of sucking or mouthing something becomes autonomous at a certain point. It deviates from and becomes a pleasure-seeking activity in its own right, in the absence of need or hunger, and in the absence of the object of need. So the register of need and of self-preservation and of instinctual reflexes that are hereditary and species-specific and are designed to assist the infant to meet that need, to establish a sort of equilibrium in the body, gives rise to this other psychical and psychosexual dimension. In Freud's case, in Freud's account, it seems to be a spontaneous emergence, except for one or two moments where he seems to sort of, where the whole paradigm swivels round and he posits the initiatory activity of the other. But on the whole, it's Laplanche who both attempts to theorize that dimension. So the drive emerges then, and Freud says, through an autoerotic turning around on itself, it becomes, as it were, crystallized out as autonomous from instinctual functioning, when the self-pleasuring repetition, the infant sticks, you know, part of its own body in its mouth. It pleasures itself with a dummy, but it also pleasures itself with its fist or its foot or whatever else. So there's that moment of, as it were, autoerotic self-pleasuring in Freud's account, which as it were, crystallizes the drive as deviant from the instinctual function. So he has this category of the autoerotic, which is foundational for the very emergence of the sexual drive as such. But other sexologists and psychiatrists at the time, whom Freud is reading, and in some sense who are reading him and are in dialogue with him, like Havelock Ellis and others, introduced the notion of narcissism. Freud says it wasn't initially his invention, verbal invention, in order to describe not infantile activity, but certain forms of adult sexuality, certain extreme forms of adult sexuality, which take the body, the own body, the subject's own body as a sexual object. And the word narcissism was invented initially to describe that. Now for Freud, that's, you know, at the level of clinical observation, that's a step forward, because it leads you to think about, well, what about this phenomenon? Okay, how do we give an account of that? But it also kind of creates a slight problem for his previous formulation, because what is this kind of narcissism in the adult to do with the autoeroticism that he describes in as the mode through which the sexual drive in infantile sexuality emerges? So what's the relationship between the two, autoeroticism and narcissism? There starts being a proliferating series of conceptual distinctions that seem to follow on, because if libido can be invested in the self, if you get a kind of ego libido, and Freud always makes a distinction between narcissistic libido that is directed to the ego, and that could mean the body ego, the most earliest and primitive form of the ego, as we saw when we looked at the ego and the id at the end of chapter 2. But that's very different from the dispersed, fragmented, autoerogenous activity, which is dispersed around the infant's body and its excitable zones. For Freud, narcissism is always directed at a single unified object, which is the ego, even if it is the ego is experienced through the body. But then there's libido that is directed towards objects. So we've got the drives, the autoerotic drives, we've got narcissistic libido directed towards the ego, we've got libido directed towards objects, and then we have, again, as usual, Freud's first encounter with this, with the phenomena that's provoking his successive conceptualizations, is extreme pathological phenomena, in which he then realizes, sometimes belatedly, that actually he's encountering something else, which is not just peculiar to that group of people, of narcissists, who can only get off on their own bodies, but some sort of larger dimension of human psychic life is encountered in extreme form. And so you can see this when he's thinking about forms of narcissism, say, in megalomania, and we'll see in the mania that is one side of melancholia when we look at the Mourning and Melancholia essay next, in a few weeks' time. But behind that narcissism, he realizes that it's a narcissism that had been previously attached to objects and is being drawn back into the ego. So, and he calls it that secondary narcissism. So we've got the autoerotic drives, we've got the instincts, the autoerotic drives, narcissistic libido attached to the ego, narcissistic libido attached to objects. And then he sort of belatedly or at some point just reflects and thinks, actually this narcissism of the attached to the ego is a secondary narcissism, and behind it is a primary narcissism, a structural primary narcissism, which lies behind and is the precondition for the possibility of the extreme forms of manic or megalomaniac or narcissistic attachment to one's own body. So what about this primary narcissism? And there does seem to be then a proliferation of conceptual distinctions. And Jung, he's in the middle of an argument, a battle with Jung, which is to end in a kind of split between the two of them. And Jung says, well, actually, why don't we just kind of, you know, just reduce the number of conceptual entities here and just say there's a single psychic energy which can become sexual when it's directed at sexual objects, okay, and otherwise isn't. And that, you know, that seems clean and elegant, you know, solution. And Freud just won't have that because he feels that what that blurs or muddles up is the complexity of the human being. And nevertheless, he does want to establish that object libido and ego libido are in a sense the same libido, but that to get to that level, that's not just pre-given. It's not just there. It's a secondary or later formation. And so he poses the question of the relationship between the autoeroticism of the drives and the narcissism of the ego. And he says something like the ego cannot exist from the beginning. Okay, the autoerotic drives are there from earliest infancy, from the first months of life. But the ego is a certain kind of formation. Well, it has to be formed, it has to come into being. We can't just posit it as always already there. And he's thinking about then the formation of the ego and the formation of narcissism in the same development of thought. And he poses this question, what psychical action is necessary to transform the fragmented, multiple, dispersed autoerotic drives into the unified libido that is attached to a single object, in the first instance, the ego? Some psychical action converts one into the other, and it produces something that is unified, through its many phenomena, through its many manifestations. So it's the same libido that is attached to the ego that gets put out into objects, and it's the same libido that is drawn back into the ego. So there's a kind of interchange between these different forms of the same libido. But something has produced that out of the polymorphous perverse autoeroticism of early infancy. And he doesn't explicitly answer that question in the narcissism essay, and indeed he doesn't go back to that formulation. The later psychoanalysts have endlessly debated the question of the new psychical action and how what one might posit at that point as formative of the of narcissism. Now, this version of narcissism, in a sense, the implication is what brings the ego into being. Okay, what unifies the drives in a single entity that is both subject and object at the same time. Okay. It's both a desiring subject and a desired object. And though he doesn't make the connection must go back to his positing of the ego as arising out of the body surface, as a bodily ego which is the result of the mental projection inwards of the surfaces of the body. And this is what Unzieux, as we saw with the notion of the skin ego, takes up and develops so richly and so interestingly. Okay, so the ego then is something that is emerges out of bodily experience, but is not something that can be just located in terms of neurology as representations in the cerebral cortex. This is a mental, a psychical entity, And it's a libidinally charged entity. Okay? It's a self-image or self-representation that is libidinally charged. And that's what distinguishes it. Now, in Freud's account of narcissism, and I should add interrupt myself for a brief moment and say this is, just as there are two versions of the ego in Freud, fighting it out in the same text, there are two versions of narcissism. Now, the second late Freudian version of narcissism doesn't appear in the 1914 paper. And that account completely collapses all these distinctions. Because in that account, the child is born already narcissistically involved in itself. And the problem is, how does the child, the little solipsist, wrapped up in itself, gain access to an external world of other people and of objects? Now, Laplanche, in the bit of Laplanche we looked at the last term, polemicizes against that account, that notion of primary narcissism. We are born in a narcissistic call, almost, and the problem is, how do we exit from it? As if we were born in a shell, to break out of our little shell. And you know, I think it's very easy to deflate that. That was a dominant account in American psychoanalysis associated with Margaret Mahler, of a kind of the baby symbiosis with the mother. She had to bring in the mother, but absorb the mother into this narcissistic sort of eggshell, as it were. It was a dominant account. And all research on child observation, etc., is that the child is open to, indeed overly open to, dangerously open to, the impacts from the external world, can't protect itself from impacts, and has to acquire an interiority which is not there from the beginning, as it were. So that later version of primary narcissism is up against the version of primary narcissism that we meet here in this paper, where it's a formation that comes at a later point. It's the moment in which the dispersed autoerotic drives that had leaned on the instinctual functions and had been implicitly dependent on the nurturing adult come together and form a unity. Now, in section 2 of his narcissism paper, Freud rehearses very interestingly the very thing that his later version of narcissism will forget. That is to say, the relationship between the drives and the instinctual functions, the relationship of leaning on. He invokes that again because he's going to use this notion of Anlehnung, of leaning on, to set up his model of these two types of love relationship. A love relationship that is narcissistic as against a love relationship that is the word that's used by Strachey, like so often. He invents this unnecessary and unhelpful technical term, anaklitic. Okay. And it comes out of Greek and Latin grammar. Where an anaklitic or an enklitic is a part word that never appears by itself, but only appears in relationship to another word, okay, leaning on the other word. And you could see almost words like dis, or syllables like dis or un or re that we add to words, prefixes and suffixes might be one example of enklitics. Or they lean on the main word, but they never appear separate from it. Okay, he uses that term to describe the relationship of leaning on, which, as Strachey does point out in the notes, is not the child leaning on the mother, but the drives leaning on the instinctual functions. And Freud then wants to derive by tracing the way in which an object is chosen. So looking at the genealogy of a given object choice as to whether the object that's chosen, the love object, is modelled on the self or the other. Okay, if they're modelled on the other, the parenting other on whom you were dependent, or are they modelled on your self-representation? So the enclitic and the narcissistic types of love relationship. And he also tries to gender them. One's a male type of relationship, the other's a female type of relationship. Though even in the process of setting that up, he qualifies it. He admits halfway through his account of a narcissistic love relationship as being a female or feminine form of love relationship, that actually he's talking about a particular type. And clearly what he's got in mind is the classic type of the femme fatale. Okay, that's what he's talking about. And that's a recognized psychosocial pattern or type. I want to sort of hang a question mark over the viability of the schema he sets up. And he outlines it on page 90. He says, a person may love, according to the narcissistic type, A, what he himself is, i.e. himself, what he himself once was, what he himself would like to be in the future, or someone who was once part of him. In the case of the narcissistic woman, loves her child. She moves her narcissism on from herself to her child, as it were, and loves her child narcissistically. So even though she loves another object, she loves it as a sort of extension of her own self-love. And according to the anaclitic or attachment type, the lover loves the woman who feeds him, or the man, the father figure, who protects him. Now, that is a distinction between the ways in which people find their way to certain forms of object choice. Okay, but what it ignores is the very thing that the whole essay has been about. Okay, that the ego, which he says at one point, is a reservoir of libido. The ego, as constituted through primary narcissism, is a reservoir of libido which it loans out to objects, but which, under certain circumstances, it can take that libido back into itself. And when we look at the mourning essay, mourning and melancholia essay, in cases of where the love object dies, for instance, the pathology that can sometimes infect mourning, and indeed to some extent which is present in all forms of mourning, is that recouping and regathering back into oneself of the libidinal investment that had been in the loved and now lost object. In that account, then, all love relationships are a form of donated narcissism. And indeed, isn't it La Rochefoucauld, I think, the great French, is he a philosopher, a commentator, talks about the state of romantic love as egoism à deux. In other words, a donation of one's primary narcissism to the other. So in that sense, all love relationships are narcissistic, because they're based on this donation of narcissism, of one's narcissism to the other figure, to the object. And if you're thinking of it in the kinds of terms, or in terms of the distinction that Laplanche has introduced between Ptolemaic and Copernican, between self-centered and other-centered, and the question of the relationship to the other, then one might push the argument a bit further to say, and the reason why, what is the reason why, or what enables one to donate one's narcissism that has brought one's very ego into being to another object, right? And that raises a question. Does this just happen spontaneously? Now, in Freud's account, implicitly it does. He gives no account of except the missing term, the direct psychical action, okay, that would produce narcissism out of autoeroticism. But as always with Freud, there's this theoretical gap or absence, but then there's this wonderful description, a comic, almost ironic description, where he moves from talking about romantic love to talking about parental love, okay? And he talks about that wonderful description of His Majesty the Baby, the parental fantasy of the baby, right? And I think in a way, that provides us with the kind of, if you like, the phenomenological description of the processes that could lead one to pose or to give a Copernican answer to the question of the direct psychical action. That is to say, let's not assume that any psychical action on the part of the subject just arises spontaneously, but that it is a response to the direct psychical action of the other. Okay, and that's what this description, a very telling and in some ways poignant description of this parental fantasy. And I just want to finish by reading this wonderful paragraph at the end of section 2. He says, the primary narcissism of children, which we have assumed and which forms one of the postulates of our theories of the libido, is less easy to grasp by direct observation than to confirm by inference from elsewhere. If we look at the attitude of affectionate parents towards their children, we have to recognize that it is a revival and reproduction of their own narcissism, which they have long since abandoned. the trustworthy pointer constituted by overvaluation, which we have already recognized as a narcissistic stigma in the case of adult object choice, dominates, as we know, the emotional attitude. Thus, they are under a compulsion to ascribe every perfection to the child and to conceal and forget all shortcomings. Moreover, they are inclined to suspend in the child's favour the operation of all the cultural acquisitions which their own narcissism had been forced to respect, and to renew on his behalf, the child's behalf, the claims to privileges which were long ago given up by themselves. The child shall have a better time than his parents. He shall not be subject to the necessities which they have recognised as paramount. Illness, death, renunciation of enjoyment, restrictions on will shall not touch him. The laws of nature and of society shall be abrogated in his favour. He shall once more become the core and centre of creation. And I think that's crucial formulation, right? This fantasy of a subject centred on themselves. Okay, that's the parental fantasy of his majesty the baby. The world is organised around his desires and needs. His majesty the baby as we once fancied ourselves. The child shall fulfil these wishful dreams of the parents, which they never carried out. Etc. Parental love, which is so moving and at bottom so childish, is nothing but the parent's narcissism born again, transformed into object love, and unmistakably reveals its former nature. So in that account, we have an account of, as it were, the narcissistic investment of the child, the parent's donation of their narcissism. And it's a donation that has a centering effect, because its carrier or its vehicle is the fantasy of His Majesty the baby, who is the core and centre of creation. And that emphasis on core and centre, I think, gives you that sense. It's like the libidinal equivalent of Lacan's mirror image. You know, okay. Here is a process of centering, but it doesn't happen spontaneously. The child is centred as a narcissistic love object by its parents. They donate their narcissism, a narcissism that they've had to suspend or renounce in some form. They donate it to the baby. And it's that process, I think, that His Majesty the baby lays down a kind of prototype or template for what Freud elsewhere calls His Majesty the ego. And interesting, he uses the same sort of ironic formulation for both the baby and the ego. His Majesty, the fantasy of His Majesty the baby, which is not initially the baby's fantasy, it's the parental fantasy of the baby, lays down the vorbild, the prototype for His Majesty the ego, that process of centering the drives, binding them into a unified narcissistic investment in the self as love object. I really wanted us to think about the ego before we moved on to Laplanche next week, because he makes use of, in particular, Anzieux's notion of the skin ego in his model, in his return to the theory of seduction. Okay, and I wanted that kind of to be in place before we get to the two tragedies in weeks 9 and 10. I wanted Laplanche's model to be up and running in your minds, and he relies on Anzieux and some notion of the ego. So that's why we're doing this now. I also wanted to situate the ego theory in relationship to drive theory, which we've been looking at. Okay, because Freud, at different points in the development of his thought, there's a big reconfiguration of all the conceptual relations between terms. Obviously, the one we looked at with the so-called inverted commas abandonment of the seduction theory in 1897, and the move towards a developmental model and a drive-based model of sexuality, is a major reconfiguration. There is a further one some 20 odd years later, which we'll be looking at mainly next term. In 1920, he writes Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and he reformulates his drive dualism so that the original opposition between, or distinction between, the self-preservative instincts and the sexual drives or trieb. It's never abandoned, but it gets kind of, as it were, slightly displaced by a new formulation of what he calls life and death drives. Okay, but associated with that is another reformulation involving the positioning of the ego, and it's what is called the shift from the first to the second topography. And again,
as with the drive theory, in a sense, Freud formulates another paradigm, but he doesn't abandon exactly the first one. So he kind of runs them together. And you might say, why can't he just make up his mind? And if he thinks the second paradigm is right, abandon the first one. And he doesn't want to do that. And in a way, it takes a sort of reflective interpretation of what's happening here to realize that it's not a simple substitution of a correct paradigm for an incorrect paradigm, or even a more adequate one for an inadequate one, but that both paradigms in some sense respond to crucial dimensions of human psychic life, or of the object of psychoanalysis, human psychic structure. And while they're in tension with each other, they nevertheless capture some crucial dimension of human subjectivity. And so, in a funny kind of way, both are necessary, yet at some level they're incompatible with each other. Okay, so what I want to do is just do a little schema on the board here about in relationship to drive theory. Okay, I mean, the first model of the drive, what we've looked at in the three essays, the old notion of instinct, spelt in Freud's German with a K, and then there's the notion of drive, Trieb. Okay, now, the instincts associated with the function of self-preservation. Okay. And the drives really are about sexuality. The moment, remember, at which Freud sees the drive as emerging from and differentiating itself from the performance of the basic instinctual functions like feeding or expulsion of bodily waste, etc., is the moment of autoeroticism, where the drive turns around on the infant's own body. A moment of sort of self-pleasuring, if you like, the infant sucking its thumb or its fist or its foot or whatever, some other part of itself. Now, in the essay we will come to look at next term, Freud formulates another concept, which is the concept of narcissism. Okay, and he differentiates it from autoerotism. So in some discourses, the two are collapsed together. For Freud, they're different. And he asks the question, what converts autoeroticism into narcissism? And he says that a new psychical action is the phrase he uses. A new psychical action is required that converts autoeroticism into narcissism. Now, autoeroticism is to do with the first state of the drive, so it's plural, and it's that polymorphous, perverse, multiple fragmented dispersion of the drives around the body and the body's surface. Whereas narcissism involves a unification, and it involves the notion of the ego. Narcissism is love of the ego, and the ego as a unified self-representation. So between the fragmented plurality and polymorphousness of the autoerotic and narcissism, something has intervened, a new psychical action, to produce a kind of unification of the drive at the level of the drives, where they're centered on not the body and its different excitable zones, but on the ego. Now, what is this thing, the ego? Freud says a number of different things about it. In one sense, it's a self-representation. Okay, at a terribly simple level, it's a self-representation, but a self-representation that has an effect. In the young narcissism essay, he kind of says it, but doesn't quite say it. That narcissism and the ego develop together. Okay, so the new psychical action is the formation of the ego as a unified self-image or unified self-representation. Okay, and this is thought in libidinal terms. It's the unification of the drives on a single object, which is the self-representation. So that the ego there is thought of as being, or he calls it, a reservoir of libido. in which the drives are all brought together in one psychical place or one psychical site or object. So the ego then is understood as both a libidinal and a narcissistic construction, definitionally. And it's from the ego as a kind of reservoir of libido that various object relations and object attachments are formed. The ego, he says, loans out its libidinal investments to different objects in the world and under certain circumstances draws them back into itself. And that gives rise to a further set of distinctions between primary and secondary narcissism. Primary narcissism is the bringing of everything together in that first moment of formation, that new psychical action that unifies the drives in the self-representation and centers the subject on itself. But that, and it's from that reservoir, as I say, that Freud imagines the ego putting out libidinal investments into different objects in the world around it. But that process of what, unfortunately, I don't know if I've commented on this before, there's this word Strachey uses, cathexis, from the Greek, very unhelpful translation. Freud's is an ordinary German term, Besetzung, which just means occupied. Okay, if you go into a public lavatory in Germany and somebody's already there, it will say so, Besetz, on the outside. And like the English word invest, it can mean it can have a financial meaning, as when you invest money or finances in a project. It can also have a military meaning. It's now slightly archaic in English, but in earlier periods, people would talk about an army investing a city, by which they meant surrounding it and then besieging it in order to occupy it. Okay, so it's the idea of an energy or a force occupying a fixed site. Okay, that's what Besetzung. And it means, and it's an ordinary everyday German word, to occupy, to invest, okay, a particular site. And Strachey translates it as cathexis. It's just this unhelpful technicality. Now, primary narcissism can be put out into the world and then drawn back again. When it's drawn back again, it takes the form of secondary narcissism. Okay, so we have primary narcissism, which is another name for it. Yes, ego libido. A libidinal investment of the ego or self-image. And when this returns to the ego in the form of secondary narcissism. Okay. So there's a sort of circuit of libidinal investments, and both the notion of mourning and of other things conceptualized at a later point in terms of this capacity of the ego to direct its libidinal investments and to disengage or decathect, to use Strachey's term, to disinvest and draw back into itself its libidinal energies. The notion here of the ego, then, is of a distinct self-representation which is boundaried, which has limits. And there are two levels of discourse in Freud's thought at which the ego is posed. One is at the level of perception, and one is at the level of the drive or libidinal investment. And in a sense, you need both registers of discourse to be able to think the nature of the ego. Some of you may be familiar with, if you've done some previous reading of psychoanalysis, an idea or a theory that's had a lot of circulation in English by the French psychoanalyst Lacan, the mirror phase. The idea that he argues that the ego is kind of crystallized out when the child looking in the mirror. In that essay, and we will be looking at it next term, it's a short little essay on the mirror phase and the formation of the ego. It's done almost entirely at the perceptual level of the child's gaze at its self-image in the mirror. Okay, the merest gesture towards the notion of libido takes place in that essay. So there's a way of thinking about the ego in terms of itself being, well, first of all, it's formed, Freud says, at certain points in his theory, around the perception consciousness system. That's in some of his formulations, he says it's the nucleus of the ego. Okay, the ego is formed around the perception consciousness system.
What is secondary narcissism exactly then? Primary brings it all together. What is the secondary narcissism?
Well, it's when the ego libido is drawn back into the ego. Okay, and it's not the primary narcissism that has formed the ego in the first place. Okay, but it's an influx of libidinal energy back into the ego when it disinvests from various object relations. And that's one of the things that initially Freud discovers and thinks about in relationship to mourning and melancholia with the loss of a loved object. That what was invested in that loved object is taken back into the ego, okay? But by the time we get to, and that's 1917, the essay on melancholia that we'll be looking at next term, along with the narcissism paper. By the time we get to these two chapters from the ego and the id, Freud, in a way that's very characteristic of him, having discovered something, a psychical process, which is manifested and visible in an extreme psychic state like mourning or melancholia, he then realizes that what he's discovered is not unique to that state, but that it is a more general process to be found in less extreme forms elsewhere. So we see him saying in chapter 3 of The Ego and the Id, in fact, he recites that fact, you know, that he'd first come across this notion of an object relationship being taken back into the ego and being turned into something else in the ego. And in chapter 3, he calls it being turned into an identification. Okay, so the lost object that was erotically or libidinally invested is disinvested, taken back into the ego, and the ego recoups that libidinal investment in the form of an identification with the lost object. So the person in extreme forms of mourning or melancholia has taken the lost object into themselves and plays out a kind of sadomasochistic drama in relationship to that internalized lost object. And that's all to come when we look at melancholia. Here he's realizing that actually that in that extreme pathological form, that's one thing, but actually this process of converting an object relation into an identification is a pervasive psychical process. Though he first came across it in mourning and melancholia. And indeed, in the course of chapter 3, you can see him saying, coming to the conclusion that actually this is how the ego is built up. The ego is built up through successive identifications with love objects that have been renounced or given up. And that this kind of internalization stroke identification is perhaps the only condition on which we can tolerate the loss of our love objects. Okay. So it then becomes a more general formative process by which the ego is built up. But before we get to that, what I was trying to do is to set up this tension in Freud's thought, at times virtually verging on contradiction, between a notion of the ego in the perceptual register, where the ego is formed around, he says, the perception consciousness system. And the way he describes it at the end of chapter 2 is the ego is what perceives the outside world. It perceives objects in the outside world. It's the place where perceptions are lodged that come in from the outside. And therefore, he wants to, by a series of rather rapid moves, to say it represents a kind of reality principle. Okay, that the ego, due to its formation around the perception consciousness system, is the embodiment in the psyche, in the mind, of an outward-oriented reality principle that checks the drives. So there's that version of the ego, what I'm calling the realist ego, the realist slash perceptual ego. And then there's a notion of the ego is built up through as a libidinal construction, as a narcissistic libidinal construction, which he elaborates in chapter 3 as being built up through a series of successive identifications. And you might say, well, how can you hold these two things together? Something that is a narcissistically loved self-representation doesn't seem like a very good description or a very good candidate to be promoted to being the embodiment of the reality principle. You'd have thought, in fact, a narcissistic construction is just the opposite of something that could be guaranteed to give you reliable self-checking information, self-restraining information about objective circumstances in the outside world. So you've got these two perspectives that are in tension with each other, and at times they seem almost contradictory. How could a narcissistically constituted ego ever come to function as a reliable embodiment of the so-called reality principle? It doesn't, on the whole, look very likely. Okay. But then Freud does this, one of his characteristic things. He elaborates that idea in a paragraph, and then by a series of sideways movements, he segues out of that realist notion, a notion that is much criticized within psychoanalysis, and Lacan just repudiates it entirely with great contempt in his Mirror Phase essay. Freud nevertheless segues out of that emphasis into something else. And he's sort of en route, this is right at the end of chapter two, he's en route to this idea of the identificatory ego made up out of reinvested or libidinal relations that have been taken back into the ego. And he does it in a very curious way, and I wanted just to trace that, because I think it's quite important. He's therefore being pulled in different directions, and he's thinking about the nature of the ego. You can see with that weird little diagram, which has been the object of a certain mockery within psychoanalysis, Freud trying to retain the two topographies together and map one onto the other. Okay, and of course what's forced him into the second topography is to realize that consciousness and ego don't map onto each other in a way at all. So that the first topography is that distinction between the conscious system, the consciousness perception system, the pre-conscious material that could be brought to consciousness through a certain kind of mental work. It's like our archive, as it were, our mental archive, our mental hard drive. And then the unconscious, which is what has been excluded from consciousness by repression, and where a considerable amount of mental or psychic energy is involved in keeping that material outside the field of consciousness. But of course it doesn't go away. It doesn't abolish it. So it remains an opaque, semi-closed system, mental system of its own, seeking always to return and re-infiltrate into consciousness. Now, he doesn't want to abandon those distinctions, but I think at some level there'd been this assumption that somehow the ego and consciousness are coterminous. And what he comes to realize is that, he says this at the very end of chapter one, the paragraph at the end of chapter one of The Ego and the Id, that what he comes up against again and again is that there are aspects of the ego that are unconscious. Okay. So that makes him realize that using consciousness or its absence as the demarcating criterion for the different mental systems is only partially useful. And it stops one from being able to think more extensively about what are the unconscious dimensions of the ego itself. And that raises the question, well, what is the ego itself? So he says there are three unconsciousnesses, as it were. There's the preconscious, which is simply descriptively unconscious but might come into consciousness. There is the unconscious, which is excluded from consciousness by repression. And there is the unconscious dimension of the ego. And the unconscious dimensions of the ego are precisely those mechanisms of exclusion and repression operated by the ego. Okay. So that the very things that constitute the system of the unconscious are themselves unconscious. If that were not the case, then Freud would be open to the kind of critique that Sartre makes of Freud, and I think doesn't quite get what Freud is arguing. But he says, how can there be a system that's unconscious? Because if you tell yourself you're going to forget something, then of course you know that that's what you've done. And therefore, that part of the mind that pushes the unconscious material into unconsciousness, you know, knows what it has done. And Freud comes up against and tries to describe a whole series of mental processes, of which altogether he puts under the heading of defense, operated by the ego, in which the ego produces effects, and it's unconscious of the fact that it has done that. So there are processes and dimensions and functions of the ego that are unconscious. So it leads him into thinking about what is it, what is that element in the ego that operates, that drives the ego to behave in this way. And he comes to think about what he calls a particular grade within the ego, which he calls the ideal ego or super ego, formed by identification with the adult, Allah, in particular the parent. So in chapter 2, he's got his model here of the ego, the site of the drives, which he labels the id. And again, Strachey's chosen all these Latin terms, ego, superego, id. Freud uses ordinary German words. He talks about das Ich, the I, the Über Ich, the over I, and das Es, which is the it. But Strachey sort of either uses Greek or Latin, I don't know, makes it sound more scientific or something. So the id, or the it, which is the site of the drives, the ego, and the Über-Ich, the over-I, or what's translated as the super-ego, which is the embodiment of sort of norms and injunctions that have been internalized through an identification with the parent or the adult figure. But the ego he has in the middle is trying to negotiate the demands of the id and the injunctions of the super-ego, and looking out nervously as the subject of perception into an outside world whose demands it also has to represent. And he says actually the ego is simply a modified, and he has this kind of odd description of the way in which the ego has been formed through the successive impact of sense data coming in from the outside onto the primitive, infantile, undifferentiated organism. The ego is formed, he says in one point, through a modification of the body id by the impact of things coming from the outside world. And he sees it as a surface differentiation. He then makes this, I'm reading now from this paragraph, about four paragraphs in from the end of chapter 2. The ego seeks to bring the influence of the external world to bear upon the id and its tendencies, and endeavours to substitute the reality principle for the pleasure principle which reigns unrestrictedly in the id. And then he offers us this proposition, which, I think is frankly unsustainable, but it's necessary for him to set up his argument. If the pleasure principle reigns unrestrainedly in the id, that's the energy source in the id, what equivalent force does the ego have if its job is supposed to be to control the drives of the id? He goes on to say, for the ego, perception plays the part which in the id falls to the drive. I'm changing the word instinct into drive because it's Trieb in Freud's German. I'll read that out again. For the ego, perception plays the part which in the id falls to the drive. The ego, perception, plays the part which in the id falls to the drive. And he goes on to say, the ego represents what may be called reason and common sense in contrast to the id, which contains the passions. All this falls into line with popular distinctions which we are all familiar with. At the same time, however, it ought only be regarded as holding good on average, or, quotes, ideally. Anything that falls into line with popular distinctions needs to be interrogated. Now, this proposition of Freud's that somehow or other, it's a profoundly unpsychoanalytical proposition, that somehow or other, the mere perception of objects in the outside world constitutes an internal energy or force in the mind that enables the ego to control the drives. Now, that's the hiccup, that's the problem. It's like a category mistake. Right? A perception of an object in the outside world has no necessary psychical force or energy, let alone does the reception of such perceptions guarantee the ability of the ego to do anything, as, you know, The ego might as well be paralyzed by fright or anxiety by its perceptions. Indeed, it's precisely that state that Freud describes when he's giving his account of trauma. What happens in a traumatic situation? The ego is taken by surprise. It wasn't expecting something. It sees something approaching and it seizes up with anxiety. It can't deal with what's about to happen. The mere fact of having a perception of something, even if it's a life-threatening situation, does not guarantee that the ego has any capacity whatsoever to do anything about it. Okay, you have to think about what are the equivalent internal mental forces that the ego might marshal in order to cope with the overriding demands of the drives. So this homology between perception and instinct, or perception and the drive, just is a no starter. And he gives a little metaphor. The functional importance of the ego is manifested in the fact that normally control over the approaches to motility, or being mobile, devolves upon the ego. Thus, in its relation to the id, it is like a man on horseback who has to hold in check the superior strength of the horse, with this difference that the rider tries to do so with his own strength, while the ego uses borrowed forces. The analogy may be carried a little further. Often, a rider, if he is not to be parted from his horse, is obliged to guide it where it wants to go. So in the same way, the ego is in the habit of transforming the id's will into action as if it were its own. I'll say that again. In the same way, the ego is in the habit of transforming the id's will into action as if it were its own. This is a very paradoxical metaphor, right? It starts out by being a metaphor offered you so you can picture in a simple way how the ego might control the id or the drives. Okay, the rider on horseback reining in his horse. Now, where is he getting the energies, the forces from to do that? Well, he doesn't have them in his own right. He borrows them from the id. That's interesting. Now, how does that work? Well, Freud says, if he is not to be parted from his horse, he's obliged to guide it where it wants to go. Okay, he's transforming the id's will into its own. So it looks there, what started out as a metaphor to exemplify the ego's control of the id and its drives, turns into an image or a metaphor that actually describes the way in which the ego continually has to capitulate to the very thing it's supposed to be controlling. It may have the illusion of control, but it has, if it's not to be parted from its horse in terms of the metaphor, it has to sort of transform the will of the id into its own. It has to accept, basically, the overall force or orientation or drive of the id. So it's a peculiar kind of impasse Freud's thought gets into in trying to set up the ego in this way. But then he does this very Freud thing. He does this kind of wonderful sideways move into another apparently unrelated issue, which is actually extremely illuminating. In the very next paragraph, he goes on, another factor besides the influence the system perception seems to have played a part in bringing about the formation of the ego and its differentiation from the id. A person's own body, and above all its surface, is a place from which both external and internal perceptions may spring. It is seen like any other object in the world, but to touch it yields two kinds of sensations, one of which may be equivalent to an internal perception. So you're touching something that, if you touch yourself, you're touching what is like an object outside yourself, but you're also feeling yourself being touched. It's an internal sensation, what in psychology or philosophy is called apperception. The perceiving self-perception. Psychophysiology has discussed the manner in which a person's own body attains its special position among other objects in the world of perception. So there's something quite special about bodily self-perception. Okay, it's in some sense foundational for one's capacity to perceive objects in the world. And he goes on to say, pain seems to play a part in the process and the way in which we gain new knowledge of our own organs during painful illnesses is perhaps a model of the way by which, in general, we arrive at our idea of the body. That's interesting. We're now moving to a notion of a general idea of the body that emerges out of a series of localized self-perceptions or apperceptions. And then he goes, and he makes this wonderful leap and this very bold proposition. The ego is first and foremost, he says, a bodily ego. It is not merely a surface entity, though that's where it starts from, but it is itself the projection of a surface. It's not merely a surface entity, it is the projection of a surface. And then we're given a little footnote to the English edition provided by Strachey, who obviously interrogated Freud on what he meant by this. And the footnote reads, "The ego is ultimately derived from bodily sensations, chiefly from those springing from the surface of the body. It may thus be regarded as a mental projection of the surface of the body, a mental projection, a projection inwards to some site in the mind, of the surface of the body and its sensations and perceptions, representing the superficies, the external edges or surfaces of the mental apparatus. So a mental projection inwards from the body surfaces into the mind." And he's using the word projection in a really curious way there. Normally in psychoanalysis, projection in the psychoanalytic sense of the term means that something has been projected from the inside outwards, as in paranoia, where the paranoid person constructs somebody as a persecutor or somebody who's listening in or knows what my thoughts are or whatever. And it's clearly a way in which the paranoid subject allows themselves to become aware of a whole set of intolerable feelings by attributing them to somebody else, and they then return from the outside. So that's what the psychoanalytic concept of projection is, projection from the inside to the outside. On the other hand, projection has a different meaning in physiology and studies of the nervous system. There, the term projection is used to describe the ways in which sensations are transmitted from the nerve ends through to the cerebral cortex. Now, Freud here is using the term in that footnote, projection, to describe a process by which a mental representation of the body, of the bodily self, is formed. It's a projection into a mental space. Okay, so it's not just like the registration in the cortex of a sensation that travels from my fingertips or wherever up my nervous system and is registered in the brain. Okay, this is a mental entity, not a physiological series of sensations registered at some point of the cortex and the brain. And indeed, in the main text, if we go back from the footnote, he has this very interesting analogy. If we wish to find an anatomical analogy for his idea of a body ego, we can best identify it with the cortical homunculus of the anatomists, which stands on its head in the cortex, sticks up its heels, faces backwards, and as we know, has a speech area on the left-hand side. So it's an analogy with the ways in which physiology has gradually mapped the projection from the nerve endings in the body surface of the body to the cerebral cortex. But of course, that mapping is actually, and I'm not going to go into why this is the case because it takes us into something more complicated in physiology, that mapping is the reverse. So that the little homunculus is the Latin word for a kind of little man. The cortical homunculus, the mapping of the whole body in the cortex, stands on its head, sticks up its heels, faces backwards. It's in reverse, as it were. And there's a whole set of physiological reasons why that's the case, etc. Now, Freud's saying the ego is like a mental analogy to that. That's what he's trying to say. It's not simply something that happens in the cerebral cortex. It's not simply a matter of physical transmissions of nervous impulses, etc. It's a transferal inwards, if you almost like a metaphorical transference, something that is an analogy or a likeness. It's like a process of mimesis takes place, in which all the information that comes from the body's surface is unified, delivered to one place and unified. And a provisional primitive mapping of the body in the mind by a kind of mental transfer takes place. That's his argument. And then he says nothing more about it. It's really quite extraordinary. Having produced this very fruitful and suggestive hypothesis, we turn the page thinking, oh, what follows from that? And what we get is now for something entirely different. And what we get there is an argument about the way the ego is built up through identification with love objects, and the way in which these love objects are renounced, taken into, introjected is the technical word, into the ego. And the ego, through this process of introjection, identification, is able to recapture the libidinal investment back into itself in a process of secondary narcissism. And he says this is how the ego is built up. The ego is built up through these successive identifications. And it's a double register he's talking or using here. On the one hand, it's a level of perception and mental images of the other. On the other hand, it's to do with the libidinal investment of the other and the mental images of the other. So this is a double register, and leads him then to see the ego as this hybrid thing that could be, in extreme cases, fragmented into its component parts, that the different identifications may be incompatible or warring in some way. And he goes on to suggest that cases of multiple personality are examples where different identifications seize control of the field of consciousness at different times. This leads into two different areas that I hope they'll talk about in the seminar. One is into the question of the Oedipus and Oedipal identification, and the way in which, in the rest of chapter 3, in this interesting series of moves, he changes the notion of bisexuality from something that operates at the level of the drives, I sexually invest members of both sexes, into a question of identification. Okay, I identify with members of both sexes, and that this is crucial to an understanding of the Oedipus complex, where the Oedipus complex has both what he calls positive and negative dimensions. So that's one very interesting and fruitful line of thought that develops, that the ego, by internalizing different identifications with different parental figures, positions, it gets positioned and builds up its own very, very hybrid, layered and narcissistic formation. The other one is the direction that Anzieux has taken in his essay on the skin ego, where, in a very rich way, he develops Freud's very bold but undeveloped notion of the body ego. And it's a very rich essay where he draws on animal ethology, studies of other species, the higher species like baby monkeys, etc. And he poses a challenge to certain versions of psychoanalysis, which is quite interesting, which prioritise, as it were, the oral relation and the oral relation to the mother's breast, etc. And he's saying that is, and it's his criticism partly of Freud, but and particularly of Melanie Klein, that this prioritisation of the infant and the infant's relation to the breast leaves out what it is that produces a unified body schema. Where does that come from? How is that produced? And his argument is basically it is to do with that first very primordial experience of the body's surfaces. Okay, so he's back there where Freud was, thinking about the body's surfaces and the way in which the body's surfaces have this kind of multiple function. One is it's like a sac. It's a containing sac in which all my insides are gathered together and contained. So it functions as a kind of very primitive form of container. It's also a kind of series of thresholds. And again, when we were thinking about the drive, this notion came up to some extent, the idea of thresholds or frontiers between inside and outside. That the orifices, which are, as it were, prioritized in the emergence of the drives, are those places where things come in and things go out, okay, in which, therefore, the infant becomes aware of exchanges taking place and of a kind of a very, very rudimentary and very primitive me, not me experience takes place around those kind of rim-like structures. And this wonderful formula that I think I quoted in the email I sent you from Anzieux about how this through these orifices the infant relates, and again in a very primitive way, to its first experience of another person. So there's sites of intersubjectivity. And he says, the massage is a message. And I think it's a really condensed and very suggestive sort of epigram. The massage is a message coming from the other. And finally, there's the notion of, there's the protective sac, there's the threshold, and there's the idea of the skin surface as being a receptor, okay, which is a development of the threshold idea, in which different things are received and, to a certain extent, filtered, it has a protective function. So these are a series of very primitive experiences of the body, and he wants to say actually sexuality. He makes a criticism of Freud, but I think he slips back into a very non-psychoanalytic idea of sexuality. He wants to say this formation of the body, of the skin ego, is pre-sexual. It's not sexual. But when you look at how he then goes on to talk about sexuality, for him, in this essay at least, sexuality is always genital sexuality. Right? So he's missing out on the radicality of Freud's proposition of the pre-genital, okay, a pre-genital eroticism. And so he attempts to split off the question of the sexual from his argument about the skin ego and only to bring it in at a later point. Okay, whereas in a way, the implications of what I've been saying, commenting on Freud, is that unification of the drives to form an ego has an inevitable libidinal dimension to it from the very beginning. But the libido that's in question is not a kind of proto-adult genital libido, okay, but it is that infantile, polymorphous, perverse libido, and that's one of the things one needs to think about in thinking about the skin ego. Okay, I'll finish there.